Welcome, everybody. You are listening to the Zep Fan All Things Led Zeppelin podcast. My name is Mark McFall, and this is episode 22. That person on that intro is very excited to see Led Zeppelin. That recording is from 1975 in New York. And another exciting thing is that person that's so excited, screaming like that, he's here today to talk to us. That's right. His name is Artie Costanzo. He is well known in the tape community for all his fantastic Led Zeppelin recordings from New York, dating back from 1971. He has recorded the band 10 times, and check this out, he has seen the band 19 times. So take that in for a moment. Quick side note before we begin this interview, I referenced the Madison Square Garden 1971 show as September 9th, 1971, when in fact it's September 3rd, 1971. So my fault, that's a correction there. Lastly, another correction. I stated he recorded the band 9 times, but in fact, he did record them 10 times. There was an issue with one of the recordings, and it's kind of a fragmented recording, and that's why that's the 10th show, but it doesn't get talked about a lot. So he's here. He's going to talk about that 10th recording. He's going to talk about seeing the band, recording the band, and everything in between. So let's get going. Let's bring on our guest. With our continuing past podcast themes of having guests that saw Led Zeppelin, today we have a double whammy. Not only has our guest seen Led Zeppelin 19 times, and I repeat, that is 19 times, he recorded 9 of those shows. His recordings have circulated in the trading community for more than 40 years and are well known for the memorable audience chatter. We have the absolute pleasure today of discussing these shows and, of course, these recordings with the man himself. Please welcome to the show, Artie Costanzo. Artie, how's it going today?
How are we doing there, Mark? Everything's fine here.
That's good to hear. Well, thank you for joining me. I know your name has been around the trading world for a long time. Hearing your tapes throughout the years and hearing your voice on all those recordings and finally talking to you, I feel like, you know, I'm talking to an old friend. When was the first time you saw Led Zeppelin, and how do they compare to the other bands at the time?
Well, real quick... Basically, me and my friends used to hang out at a pizzeria in Brooklyn, and our major thing to do in our free time was either play sports or go to music concerts, and we were trying to find the band. We were trying to find the best band out of all we had seen. We had seen a lot of them. One Friday night, I was standing at this pizzeria when one of the guys we called the gang guys came to the pizzeria and said to me, "You want to go to the Fillmore Friday night? I got a ticket for the late show. It's Delaney and Bonnie. You don't have to pay me." I went, "Yeah, sure, I'll go." He gave me the ticket, and that night came, and I went. I went to the Fillmore East, and then when I was outside, basically I saw one of the other guys I used to know there, and we both walked in, and we went to go see Delaney and Bonnie. That's all we knew. And we went down to the bathroom to smoke a joint. I heard the initial opening act, and the initial opening act sounded familiar. And I realized it was this new band called Led Zeppelin. Well, I kind of looked at my friend and I said, "Who's the opening act?" Okay. And he said, "It's some band called Fred Zeppelin." I said, "Fred Zeppelin?" I says, "You mean like Led Zeppelin?" He says, "Yeah, I think that's it." He says, "Well, I know the song. Let's go upstairs. Let's see what they're all about." We ran upstairs. I had fifth row tickets. I sat there. They just started playing How Many More Times. Let me tell you something. The initial time I saw Led Zeppelin on stage, the first thing that hit me was there were these tall guys. Nice. Plant was 6'2". Jimmy Page was 6'1" with the hair. John Paul Jones was over 6 feet. They looked like the front line of the New York Knickerbockers, I'm telling you.
Right
off the bat. And they started doing How Many More Times, and Plant is the guy that grabs your eye. As a front man,
right. He
was really spectacular. All right. Well, they went into the song. Jimmy Page brings out the violin bow. He starts doing a violin number. I'm just glued to my seat. And then they went into communication breakdown, and they were done. And we watched Delaney and Bonnie. And I went outside my friend, and I says, you know, I think I found the band my friends have been looking for. He says, Delaney and Bonnie? I says, no, it's Led Zeppelin, all right? So basically, coming back home, I met all my friends at the pizza parlor, and they said, well, tell us about Delaney and Bonnie. And I said, forget about Delaney and Bonnie. It's Led Zeppelin. It's Led Zeppelin. And one of the other guys that was there said, you know, they're playing at the Garden in 1970. Tickets are going to go on sale. I says, okay, we got to get tickets for this, and we got to see them up close. Okay, we got to see how good they really, really are. So I says, how do we get tickets to make sure that we get good seats? One of the gang said, well, you can go to the Garden the night before, and you could stay in the alcove, and they have police barricades set up, and they start selling tickets at 9 o'clock in the morning. And you get the best seats directly from the Garden. I said, okay, that sounds like the thing to do. So I collected $750 from everybody, $150 for 20 tickets. There was no ticket limits in those days. We got to Madison Square Garden 6 p.m. the night before tickets went on sale. There were police barricades set up. We were about number 9th and 10th online. It was me and my friend Lee. All right. During the night, the guy in front of us, who was the number 8th guy in the line, was an older fellow, around 30 years old, in a top flight suit. During the night, 2 or 3 times, he asked us to keep his place online while he went to get some coffee and pizza. Okay. He got something for everybody. He was a really cool guy.
Nice.
All right. Well, about 8 o'clock in the morning, tickets went on sale 9 o'clock. He says, hold my spot one more time. I got to get something. I said, sure, man, do what you got to do. He disappears. He comes back with an attaché case. He gets back online in front of us. When they started selling tickets, they took the first 10 people to the will call where they sold the tickets. Now, when this fellow went up to go buy the tickets, okay, I was going to get 20 tickets. This guy, the mature guy, I'll call him, I don't remember his name, said he wanted 800 tickets.
Wow. What?
Best,
oh, wow.
Best seats available.
Right.
$60,000. My heart sank because I knew that where we were in line, we were probably going to be in the first 2 rows.
Yeah.
After he took his 800 tickets and Ticketron pulling tickets from all over the city, we were in row O of the second layer of orchestra seats. We were 41 rows away from the stage. Still great seats.
Right, right.
Okay. But 40 rows, you know, was not row 2. That's for sure. All right. So anyway, we go off to September 19, 1970, the Garden, the Sea Led Zeppelin. After the announcer called out, the band came out at about 8:15. All right. The first 4 sections, everybody stayed on their feet and then got on top of the chairs. So we had to see the whole show standing on our chairs, which was a real pain in the neck.
Right, right.
Real pain in the neck, especially in those days. Okay, Robert Plant came out. They did the first couple of songs. And then he made a short announcement about the death the day before of Jimi Hendrix, who had died on September 18th. All right, when they went into Whole Lot of Love from the second album, everybody just freaked out, jumped on their chairs, and we finished up the show, okay? And it was a great show. But again, I would have liked to have seen it closer.
Yeah.
All right. We left the Garden, we went to the pizza store, and we realized this is probably the band, all right? A few weeks later, it was announced that Led Zeppelin would return at Madison Square Garden September 3rd, 71, for an evening show. Tickets to go on sale at the new Ticketrons only and not at the Garden. Then Ticketron was selling at kiosks all over the place. Now, the funny thing about Ticketron was the way they sold their tickets, you could be first online. You could have stayed there all night long.
Right.
But once you got to the front, they had a bucket, a red bucket with theater tickets inside, small little theater tickets. If people remember going to theaters, movie theaters, they were tiny little tickets, and you would stick your hand in, pull out a ticket, and the ticket would be 00001 to about 200. But the problem was you were picking out just a random ticket. You could have been first online and be pulling out 00100. You were not guaranteed a ticket that way. But I was able to get tickets, and we were in pretty good shape. Okay.
Oh, very
now,
nice.
Now, the other interesting thing that happened to me during that time was that I got a job at Lafayette Radio Electronics at Warren Street, Manhattan.
So I just want to confirm, you're talking about 1971 now.
This is the 71 show. That would have been September 9th of 1971.
Okay.
This was the tickets for that show.
Right.
All right. The important thing about Lafayette Radio in regards to all of this was that I was in charge of all the equipment, all the new stuff that came into the store. I would bill and lade it. I would check in everything. And I would take all the new units and put them in the glass showcases that they would sell. And Lafayette Radio was dealing with stereo sets. They were the kings of buying your amps, your preamps, your speakers, right, and your turntables, and also tape recorders. And they got the first cassette players in New York City at the time.
Wow.
And Sony sent in about 15, I remember, when they came in. And I remember I was playing with these things for weeks, okay?
Nice.
And then finally, they sent out a recorder player. The recorders were a little later than just the players, okay? Yeah. The trouble was that the recorders were pretty big. You remember what a Walkman looked like.
Right, of course. Yeah.
Of course. The trouble is that the recorder players were about three times the size of Walkmans in the beginning.
Yeah.
Okay, so sneaking this into Madison Square Garden would be a little bit of a chore, all right? I realized that I had a little bit of a problem. So what I basically came up with, the cassette recorder had a handle on it, and you used to walk it in like a radio. I put a piece of rope on it, put it under my armpit, put it horizontally, wore a small little jacket, and I walked into the place with it.
Nice. So this is a traditional cassette player, like that has the long kind of speaker, has the cassette, and then underneath the cassette is where the record, play, fast forward, and rewind button is, and they have that handle right underneath it. Is that the type of recorder we're talking about?
Exactly what it was. Okay. And what made this unit interesting also, this unit you could record in stereo.
Ah.
Okay, and it had two small microphones built into the unit at the extreme left side of the unit and the extreme right side of the unit. The only problem, like I said, it was kind of big.
Right.
In the beginning, they didn't miniaturize it quite as good as they could do, you know. And anyway, got to the garden, like I said, put it under my armpit. I had like what they call an Eisenhower jacket on, mm-hmm, which is a really lightweight jacket at the time. And we got it in there, okay. And also, we had floor seats, but we had bad floor seats all the way in the back. But we were on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We were on the floor. And what we did is, as soon as we got on the floor, we got to the garden. As soon as they opened up at 7 o'clock, we sat in the first couple of rows. And as people started filtering in, if we were sitting in somebody's seats, we would say, oh, sorry, yeah, we made a mistake. Mm-hmm. We would just move a couple of seats over. Now, we did this, okay. And Led Zeppelin never had really an opening act,
nope,
at least that I know of.
Nope.
And as soon as they hit the stage, okay, and everybody, for some reason, more so than any other band that I had seen, people got kind of excited and kind of like ran to the stage. And what we did the same thing.
Right.
We ran to the stage and we stayed in the empty space between the first row and the stage itself. Now, in those days, early on, the stage was only about 3 feet off the ground.
I know, isn't that awesome? Yeah.
That was really short. In other words, just about at the middle of your chest, you could, you know, put your hands on the stage. Of course, it changed after that. They got a press pit and all this stuff. But in those days, you could really get close, okay? So what we did, you know, and a lot of it was due to me, we just stood up, and we went right by the stage, and we stayed there. And we were left alone for about 3 or 4 songs. Maybe a half an hour. Then people started screaming, sit down.
Rascal, sit down.
And it got a little loud after a while. And what happened after a bit, when you could hear it on the tapes, people really screaming, you could actually hear my voice go, sit down on the ground. And everybody went down to the ground.
Nice.
And they basically left you alone. You were not blocking, you know, the visual. You could see everything, and everything was working fine. Okay. On that tape, if you listen to the tape, I think at about the 30-minute, 40-second part of the tape, mm-hmm, what happened was a real security guard came over and started working the people sitting on the floor to my extreme right. He had a little flashlight. He'd go over to people, and I was watching him, and he would, you know, talk to them. I couldn't hear what he was saying. And I could imagine he was asking for their tickets. And people would take out their tickets with his flashlight. He would look at it. and say, and you could see him shaking his head no, and he'd point somewhere, obviously where this guy was supposed to be sitting, and the guy would stand up, and he would go. Now, I also noticed he was making headway. He moved about 15 people.
Wow.
And we were about another 20 people away from him, and I knew we were in trouble. I knew we were in trouble because he was going to get us eventually.
Yeah.
He's going to move us away. Now, what happened then was a young lady was sitting there with really long hair, and she had her hair in a ponytail, and her hair was just about as long as her waist. So I saw the guy talking to her, the guard, the real security guard, and she obviously had been in protests before because she realized that if you laid down and you made yourself dead weight, the guy couldn't pick you up.
She knows the drill.
She knew the drill. So she laid down, crisscrossed her arms, and just laid there. And the guy got frustrated. I could see it.
Right.
He got frustrated. But what he did was he grabbed her by the ponytail, and he started to drag her.
My.
And she started screaming because I'm sure it hurt. Okay.
Right.
This was during Dazed and Confused. Robert Plant just happened to be on that side of the stage when this is happening, and it caught his attention. He comes on over right to the edge of the stage, and again, the stage is only 3 feet off the ground. And with his foot, he tapped the guy on his shoulder. And the guard turns around and looks up at Robert Plant, and with his right hand, he did that no, no, no index finger move.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Right.
So the guard let the girl down. He kind of put up his hands in frustration, dropped them, and he left.
Wow.
Okay, the moment he left, Nikki, one of the gang who was sitting next to me, he stuck his face in my ear, and he said, "We can get on the stage." He knew. I didn't know what he was talking about then,
yeah.
But he knew we could get on the stage. Okay, fine. Well, everything was going fine, no problem. But what was going on, the rest of the crowd realized the security guys were not doing anything, and that the talent didn't care about it. So they started filling in any empty spots that there were. Initially, if there was 50 people sitting on the floor, now there was a couple of hundred people sitting on the floor. And it was starting to get a little hairy,
mm-hmm.
like festival seating where there was pushing. And, you know, you were getting pushed into the stage and you were getting crushed. Okay. And what happened was we were there for maybe an hour, and all of a sudden they announced John Paul Jones' organ solo. Okay. So John Paul Jones starts doing his organ solo. He's the only guy on the stage, and the organ is right by us, right by the left side of the stage. Stage right, our left. Okay.
Right.
So a couple of people get up, and they kind of like just did this kip up, and they sit on the edge of the stage.
Wow.
And then a few other people get up, and a few other people get up, and then my friend Nikki says, "I'm going up." He goes up, gets on the stage, and you can hear on the tape that we're laughing and carrying on. And he sticks his hand out to me, grabs my hand, pulls me up on the stage.
Wow.
So I'm on the lip of the stage, and then I move forward a little bit, and probably about 4 or 5 minutes into it, I'm maybe 10 feet away from John Paul Jones. I start to feel the stage move a little to the left and move a little bit to the right.
Mm.
It was actually moving, and I realized, wow, this thing is being affected by the weight because all the people were at the front of the stage. All right. He finishes his organ solo. The rest of the band comes out, and they start doing "Thank You." Okay, and Plant is singing, away they go, and about a minute and a half into it, the stage lurches forward.
Wow.
And where I was, I guess it was 4x6 sheets of plywood made up the whole stage. The stage just cracked at the meeting of the plywood, and everybody fell off.
Hmm.
And you could hear the crackling in the recording.
Wow.
And luckily, you know, we weren't too high off the ground. I literally just rolled off, landed on my feet. Okay. And Robert Plant jumps on top of one of the monitor speakers, and he says, "You got to move back. You got to move back, or we can't go on. You got to move back. People can't see."
You got to move back. Move back. The people can't see. Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back.
Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back. Move back. Who rides back and stuff fans from everybody else?
And there was about a 2 or 3 minute delay, and a crew comes out with a floor jack, one of these hydraulic floor jacks. And they stick it under the front of the stage. They jack it up.
Wow.
and they got it up, okay? And they had like maybe a 2-3 foot tree trunk that they wheeled in. They set it up straight, stuck it in the hole. They let it down, and the stage was up again. Whoa. And everything was cool. And Robert Plant says, okay, we're going to do a new song called It's Been a Long Time. It was rock and roll.
Oh, cool.
But they called it It's Been a Long Time. And they finished up. And they left, and let me tell you, what a show.
A lot of memories on that
one. What an experience, and what a recording that was.
I know, I could imagine. Well, speaking of the recording, let me ask you a little bit about the recording experience. It sounds to me the mics were internal mics. You didn't have a mic that you held in your hand. You're just using that.
Not on this unit. I was lucky enough, that's why I brought the unit. There was it looked like little grills on the left side and the right side of the unit. Like I said, it was like maybe the unit was 10 inches wide. Mm-hmm. And that's why it was great. You would just put the tape in, record and play, and you had a little VU meter, two of them, as a matter of fact, for left and right. It was stereo. And that was it. The only problem was, like I said, it was a little big. Eventually they got smaller. But for that one show, I didn't think I was going to get in, and I got it, and I was lucky.
So, and you just kept this strapped around your shoulder and just kind of let the recorder just hang on your body and record whatever recorded?
No, actually, what I did was, as soon as I got in, I took it out from under my armpit, because instead of keeping it horizontal in my armpit from, say, east to west, I had it north to south in my armpit, and you would not get a good recording. So I just held it by the handle. You know, early on in 1971, I guess they really didn't think so much that people would try to come in and record these shows. You know, right after that, other shows that I went to, they started patting you down and checking you. So it started getting a little hairy after that show. I got lucky in that show.
Yeah.
Period. I mean, I got on the stage, recorded it.
With or without recording, right? You're on the stage.
Got a good recording, a full recording.
Yeah.
You know, and the funny thing is, the thing that always got to me, Mark, was that I thought there'd be 10 sources of this show that would come out. I've never heard another source.
Well, and that's the interesting thing about a lot of the New York recordings. There's not a ton of them. And some of them are even, you know, going deeper into like 77. Some of them aren't even complete. Like the June 14th, 1977 show comes to mind. So let me ask you, I mean, as your time and being a fan, being in the audience, meeting other people from New York, have you met other tapers that have the shows that haven't released them?
You know, I've not met anybody. Just to throw out a quick story at you, the only reason I even know that I existed as a person of interest, because I recorded, you know, the shows, in the 1980s, I was in Manhattan at a flea market.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy at a flea market, his name was Willie, and he was playing one of my tapes, because he was selling live tapes.
Yeah.
And I went over to him, and I says, hey, you know, that's my tape. I recorded that tape. And he goes, are you Artie?
Wow.
And I says, yeah. He says, we've been looking for you for years. I says, well, I'm right here. And I became friendly with him. And that's how I discovered there was a taping community. And people, you know, they collected these tapes. They wanted to know what machines you used, what kind of tapes you used.
Yeah.
You know, all of this stuff. Before then, I never even knew that people gave a darn.
Right. Well, I'm assuming by mid-80s, that's when, you know, the tape trading community was getting going with Led Zeppelin, and we're kind of needing more of Led Zeppelin and hunting down the bootlegs. I'm sure you got pretty busy and got contacted quite a bit from people who want to hunt down the masters and find the best source. Is that what happened?
The funny thing is, I got contacted, but not much. I would say I got contacted by 3 or 4 people. That was it.
Right. Okay.
I mean, you know, Grant from Canada,
sure,
who had the fanzine. He got in touch with me, but not like as you would think they would be. But I think after Led Zeppelin finished up in 1980, there was more of an interest because people realized they were not going to see them,
right,
who had never seen them, and they wanted to get the copies of the tapes because their performances were so legendary.
Right, I agree. I also know with collecting, sometimes people like to have high trade value, so a lot of people won't let out tapes, or they'll want to trade for higher, you know, higher quality too. So was that your mentality when it came to trading tapes or letting them out, or did you just find yourself just collecting and selling them, or either just, you know, collecting them for getting other live material? Did you collect a lot of bootlegs back in the day, a lot of live recordings?
Well, you know what it was, too? I wasn't just recording Led Zeppelin. I was recording a lot of bands. Recently, maybe in the last couple of years, I was kind of cleaning out my garage, and I was kind of putting all my tapes together of stuff that I actually recorded.
Wow.
And I must have 800 or 900 tapes of bands I recorded.
Ooh.
I mean, you know, I got stuff. I really have to sit down and figure out what I have to figure out if I have anything really kind of rare or really kind of interesting. You know, I did the basics. Led Zeppelin, The Who, Pink Floyd,
the big bands,
Eric Clapton, you know, whoever I went to go see. Luckily, I went to a lot of shows.
Sure sounds like it. I mean, 19 Led Zeppelin shows alone, I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, Led Zeppelin, I kind of keyed on.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of keyed on Led Zeppelin. And then after Led Zeppelin was finished, I kind of keyed a little bit on Pink Floyd because I really enjoyed Pink Floyd. But the major difference with the Led Zeppelin and everything else was that the Pink Floyd shows that I went to, especially after Roger Waters left,
yeah,
I started taping them from the wall on. The Pink Floyd shows, because they were so visually striking, they didn't do anything different from show to show.
Right.
You know, I must have 100 Pink Floyd shows with David Gilmour and the rest of the guys,
mm-hmm,
where if you didn't know what date it was, they pretty much all sound the same.
Yeah.
You know, Zeppelin in the beginning did Elvis Presley stuff. Ugh. They did Blueberry Hill, they did stuff from, you know, and so that was really, really interesting. That's why this stuff sticks out more than a lot of others.
Well, and I think that's the beauty of Led Zeppelin too. I mean, you're talking about some bands sound the same from night to night. With Zeppelin, I mean, they just cut loose. I mean, it always varied from night to night, and they're always pushing the limit. So whatever felt good, they went with it. So that's the great thing about them live. And I think that's what kept, you know, talking about the 80s, I think that's what kept the community alive,
yeah,
all the, you know, Led Zeppelin fans, because, wow, there's more out there. There's these bootlegs. We could hunt these down.
You know, and there was one other thing too about Led Zeppelin was what I noticed early on with them was, of all the other bands I saw, Led Zeppelin had four great musicians,
right,
that could carry the whole thing. You know, and the good thing about that was, if Robert Plant's voice was a little under the weather that night, Jimmy Page could have a super night and make up for that, or vice versa. You know, that was the thing that made Led Zeppelin really special too. They were like great musicians, all four of them.
Right, and when they're all on. So yeah, it's pretty amazing. Just to recap, we talked about the Fillmore East, May 30th, 1969, September 19th, 1970, the evening show. And then you just talked about Madison Square Garden, September 9th, 1971. Let's dive into 1972.
72 is Nassau Coliseum. Led Zeppelin didn't play at the Garden in 72.
Interesting.
The prevailing thought is that Peter Grant had an argument with the Garden because they were splitting the money 60-40. 60% to the group, 40% for the Garden. For the garden, and basically Peter Grant said no, it's too much. He said, I want 90% of the,
right,
of the gross, and they said, nah, you're crazy, you're not going to get 90% of the gross. And he says, well, if I'm not going to get 90% of gross, I'm going to go to that place in Uniondale, Nassau Coliseum. That's a really nice place. They're going to give me 90%. And the Garden said, good luck to you. And they did the shows in 1972 in Nassau Coliseum. Now what I did, basically, with Nick and my girlfriend at the time, is I sat down and I figured, okay, I was on the stage in 71. What can I do in 72? And I was figuring, how can I top this?
Right.
Can I do anything better? Well, I want to get a great recording, of course, but how can I top this? Well, we went to Nassau Coliseum early in the year to see Jethro Tull, and I realized that the security personnel at Nassau Coliseum wore black T-shirts with white block lettering in the chest that said Nassau at the top and Coliseum at the bottom. And on their backs, in white lettering, it said security. and my girlfriend happened to be working in the village at a place called Jimmy's T-Shirt City.
Hmm.
Okay. And I told her, I says, niece, that was her name. I says, can you make me up a T-shirt, a Hanes T-shirt, that looks just like what those guys are wearing? She says, what are you thinking? I says, just can you do it? And she said, sure. So she made me up a T-shirt. We get tickets. We go to the National Coliseum. I wore a T-shirt inside out when we got into the Coliseum, so nobody would know what the hell I was doing. Went to the bathroom, took the T-shirt off, turned it the right way, which said National Coliseum and security in the back. And the prevailing thought was I would take my friends and my girlfriend and put them in seats, because that's what these guys were doing too. They were showing you to your seats.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I put them in the first three or four rows, and I would keep my eye on them, and I actually helped dozens of other people to their seats. Okay. And I did this. I did this for about an hour. Then Led Zeppelin, kind of like, they freaked me out here because they usually go on stage late. They went on stage exactly at 8 o'clock, and I was stuck looking up at the stage all the way stage right in the middle of nowhere. I couldn't go anyplace. There was no seats there. I didn't know what to do.
Right.
So again, they had a stage only about 3 feet off the ground. I just hopped the stage and I went on the stage and I stayed behind John Paul Jones's organ for about an hour. and nobody gave a shit.
Yeah.
Nobody cared. You know, finally I got my elbows on his organ and I'm watching the show. I'm in shock. And Nikki had the tape recorder. I didn't have tape recorder. Right. I had the second tape. So finally I get a tap on my shoulder and I look around. It's three really big security guys. Okay. Really big security guys with the same shirt I got on. One of the guys goes, who are you? And I go, my name is Jerry. I'm on the list in the security office.
Right.
I'm filling in for the guy who's sick. Okay. And this guy who tapped me on the shoulder says, I'm the head of security. I don't know who you are. Let's go. They put their arms under my armpits and they drag me away.
Oh, wow.
They drag me away to behind the stage. And there's offices behind the stage.
Right.
You know, there's a whole bank offices and the office of security. And they open up the door and I go in and there's all these guys laying around, kids probably who got into the show,
right,
who are like out cold, probably too much drugs. Okay. They're staring at the walls, a little bloodied. These are probably all guys who are having fights and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And they bring me up to the head of security, sitting at a desk with a gold nameplate. And he looks at me and he says to the guys dragging me in, he says, what's this guy all about? And they say, he's acting like a god. He's been on the stage for like an hour. What do we do with him? Okay. And I look at the head of security. He goes, okay, you find a seat. You sit down. The police paddy wagon is coming. You're arrested with the rest of them.
Oh, wow.
And I look at this guy and I says, wait a minute. I says, wait a minute. What are you going to arrest me for?
Yeah, right.
Wearing a Nassau Coliseum T-shirt.
Right.
I got a ticket. And I pulled out my ticket. And I gave it to the guy, and he looks at the ticket. He says, okay. He says, take off the shirt, turn it inside out. You two guys, the security guys that dragged me in, he says, you take this guy to his seat, and you stay with him for the whole show.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they dragged me to my seat, which is all the way in the back of the orchestra. If the stage is 12 o'clock, my seats were at 6 o'clock. I was all the way, as far away from the stage as you get. And these guys stood up and stayed with me.
Really?
For the whole show. Yeah, wow. They stayed. When the band went off, they did two encores. When the band went off, they left. And I stayed there, and I didn't have the machine. I had the second tape. Nikki, and on the tape, you could hear Nikki go, Artie, where are you? Because the tape is running out. He didn't know what to do.
Right.
And then I met him up at the car, and we came home. But the other thing was, it was a great recording. I got on the stage 2 years in a row.
Wow.
Nobody ever did that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Nobody ever did that.
Yeah, that's very good. That's pretty gutsy too, wearing a shirt like that and going for it.
Well, again, you know, I was pragmatic at the time. I just figured if I could come up with a way of doing it, I'll do it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was easy in those days because unfortunately, with all the trouble and terrorism around the world,
yeah,
you could get away with it in those days, you know. Mm. If you didn't seem like a freak, you know, you could do that.
Right. All right. Well, so that recaps 1972. Now we're going to move on to The Song Remains the Same, essentially. So you went to all three nights of Madison Square Garden, July 27th, yep. 28th, and 29th. I'm assuming correct. You saw all the film crew on the stage. Talk a little bit about those shows and what you recall about the film crew, the recordings, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I do remember them running around with cameras on their shoulders and all that. But just to preempt it a little bit, was having really trouble getting tickets.
Wow.
Led Zeppelin had released, you know, the fourth album. I mean, they were as popular as the Beatles.
Right.
I mean, getting tickets was really, really difficult. Got tickets, but I got really crap tickets. I mean, I was like in the second section going up, nowhere near the floor seats. I didn't know what I was going to do because I wanted to record this show too.
Yeah.
And one of the gang at the pizza parlor one night, you know, says, you know, I'm going to the show too. His name is Danny. And I said, Danny, where are you sitting? He says, I got floor seats, fourth row.
Wow.
I said, you're kidding. I said, Danny, you got to take the tape recorder in. You got to record the show. Now, Danny was good. He was an electronics guy. He understood about taping. He was a very good guy to do this. The only problem with Danny is there were certain people in this world who could never get to any place on time.
Yeah, I know those people.
Danny was one of those, unfortunately. He'd get to the garden, go get a beer, have a second beer, get a piece of pizza at Sbarro's, turn around. It's an hour late, and he'd come in, and the tape that you play from July 27th, 1973, it starts from the middle of the rain song.
Right, right.
Okay. And the first 35, 40 minutes is gone. It's just not there. But the incredible thing about that particular show, again, there's no other source to that show.
Yeah.
And this is all these songs between Dazed and Confused, Whole Lotta Love, and the Rain Song that they used in the movie, but they edited them three or four times in the movie.
Oh, yeah. The movies you are know? Horribly edited. And
yeah, the movie's all edited and all messed up and stuff like that. But and the songs on my tape are absolutely perfect.
Yep.
And probably the cleanest versions of anything they did in that whole tour. Mm. So that's a really important tape, too.
So we got to blame it on Danny for not the complete show, right?
Yeah, Danny, I could have killed him, man. I mean, but I give him credit because, again, he got a great tape. You got to be happy with what you get. It's that type of a thing. Yeah, his tape is, and it's not only is it clean, it sounds really good. It's a little over, you know, a little over processed a little bit, but it's okay. Danny gets a heads up on that one. And I saw the other two shows, didn't record those, but we got a really good tape for that one. And a lot of people always talk about that tape.
Yeah.
They say it's the best Dazed and Confused ever.
Well, let me ask you about the thought process on recording, because you went to tons of shows, you recorded this one, but you didn't record the other two. What was the thought process back then and why you didn't record the other two?
You know, the thought process was that I really dug Plant. In the
right.
beginning, I thought Plant was the guy. You know, I realized how good Page was, how important he was, but Plant was the thing that kind of made Led Zeppelin special.
Right.
However, Plant's voice at times got a little sore.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually would sit down and say, okay, like in 75 when I saw them six times, in 77 also, I tried to take the first show of the tour in New York, give him a day off to recuperate his voice, do the third show, and then do the fifth show. I figured he would have his best nights. One,
right.
three, and five. You know, that's the way I did it. And I also wanted to see it. And as it got later on in the tour, like I said, in their career, it just got harder to get tickets
right.
that were good. If you were sitting in the third section of Madison Square Garden, you were going to get this cavernous recording that wasn't worth anything. You know, I just tried to get it when I had the good seats, which I had in 75. I recorded most of the shows.
For the 1973 shows, did you use the same recorder?
No, what was happening was I had left Lafayette Radio by then, but, you know, I still knew of all the really good sound stores on Radio Row and Warren Street. I was buying two or three portable tape recorders every year.
Oh, wow.
Sonys and things like that. Sony had some professional Walkmans come out. I still got them, and some of them still work. They were professional. They had direct drive. There was no belts in these machines.
Yeah.
So they weren't making that wheeling noise. Some tapes you can hear go... In the recording.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't get that. And that's what I would use. And I got some really good recordings from that machine too. You know, and again, I was limited on the size of the machine because in 75 and 77, they check you really closely. You know, I wish I had stock in there because I used to take my legs and I used to near my legs. I used to wear bell bottom pants and I would put it in a sandwich bag, the machine, and I put duct tape. I duct tape it to the inside part of my calf.
Right.
And that's how I would get the machine in, because they were checking you. They were checking your pockets. They were checking your chest, you know. So, you know, the machine had to be small enough to put on your leg.
Yeah.
And that was the important thing. Like I said, I wanted to get a recording than to not get a recording.
Yeah, exactly. For being concerts in July, I mean, how were the fireworks situation? Because on a lot of those July bootlegs or live recordings, we always hear fireworks, MAs going off. Yeah. How was that? Do you have any recollection of any fireworks going on?
Yeah. One night, again, I would have to check myself. I think it was in 77. One night, somebody took a flare and threw it into the upper deck of Madison Square Garden, and there was a fire. A small fire, and they put it out fairly quickly, and Plant gets on the microphone and he goes, "What's wrong with you people? You got to stop doing that. You're going to set someone on fire. Please, no more of the exploding thing." And yeah, it wasn't as bad as you think it was, but on my 77 tapes, almost every night, there is an exploding thing happening near where I was. You know, thank God that's kind of stopped a little bit now.
Yeah.
You know? But that's a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Because I was a firework guy.
Yeah.
And I've had a couple of friends of mine lose fingers.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not the way to go.
Especially you're lighting them and throw them in a crowd. That's just not smart at all.
You know what it is? Unfortunately, it was the drugs.
Yeah.
You know, you get people who are drunk.
Yeah.
And they go, "Yeah, I want to throw a firework, you know, Robert Plant." You know?
Yeah. Not smart at all. Let's go to the 1975 shows. 75, I feel, is just one of the coolest live years for them. Just the way they looked, they were on top of the world. They were, you know, literally the hammer of the gods at that point. They were rock
absolutely
gods. They looked the part. They played the part. They moved on stage. They just looked fucking cool. So talk to me about
Well, remember too, Mark, you got to remember, their contract with Atlantic Records expired.
Right.
Okay, they had a 5-year contract with Atlantic Records, okay? And basically, they got their own label, Swan Song. All right. So they owned everything. They owned every day. They were printing money.
Mm-hmm.
And Atlantic Records was still distributing the records. So Atlantic Records was still making a bunch of money, too. OK. The Garden show, just as an overall view real quick. One night I sat front row and I'll tell you how I got those tickets, too. But the 75 shows that I saw, they were the most relaxed, the most easygoing professional band that I ever saw as Led Zeppelin in Madison Square Garden. It was like they were playing in my kitchen and I was sitting at the end of a long table watching them. It was just spectacular. Plus, because it was their, you know, their fourth or fifth big tour of the United States, fans were relaxing a little bit. There wasn't all this push to the stage. People were sitting in their seats and like the last Pink Floyd shows that I saw, just enjoying the show.
Yeah.
You know, that made a big difference. That also made a big difference. The 75 are the most enjoyable out of all the ones I saw.
Right.
And again, I taped them, and I got really... Well, one thing I did do was that, again, like I was saying, I had a lot of trouble getting tickets in 73. And again, I sat down and I said, I got to do something. I got to get an edge. How am I going to get better tickets? You know, they had this bucket. You stuck your hand in the bucket. You took out a movie ticket, and that's when they called the numbers. So what I did, just out of luck, one day I was, you know, I had a job at a bowling alley at that time, and I used to use sticks because I didn't have a magnet. I used to use sticks. I would put double-sided tape on the sticks to pick up screws and stuff in between the machines. And I did it one day, and I said, you know, I could put this tape on my hand, and when I stick my hand in the bucket, my index finger and thumb, I'll come out with one ticket, but the rest of my hand, I'll have like 30 or 40 tickets, and I'll just take it out of the bucket, and I'm in like Flynn. And I did that, and let me tell you something, Mark. I did that for years, and they never caught me.
Yeah.
They never caught me on that. And I did it. I pulled out about 30 tickets, and all of the shows at the Garden, I was in the first 15 rows of the orchestra.
Oh, nice.
Okay. But then the other story real quick, just because it comes in at the right time. Nick, one of the gang, and I usually go to shows, so he was real good with this, calls me up about a month before the 212-75 show, and we had really good tickets for that one. We had Loge tickets, 47 by the side of stage. You could spit on the stage. It was so close. He goes, Artie, he says, I know we got good tickets for the 12th. He says, How would you like to sit front row?
Wow.
Dead center front row. I says, how are you pulling this off? He says, a girl that I know, because Nicky was a binder. Mm-hmm. He used to make the bindings for books in Wall Street. He says, a girl that I know's brother, he printed the tickets for the Garden, and they had to stay 24 hours to print all six nights, and each one of these six guys got four front row tickets, and this guy's not a rock fan. He wants to sell the tickets. I said, how much? Tickets were like $750 mm-hmm. list price. He goes, $75 a piece. And I went, absolutely. Just grab what you can grab. Nice. Think about that. Front row, yeah. Section O, on the aisle, $75 and 77 for 75, excuse me, for Led Zeppelin. Wow. I mean,
not a bad incredible. View. Not a bad view.
Not a bad, not only was it not a bad deal, real quick, the show itself, while I'm talking about it, was a day after it snowed, 8 inches of snow in the city. And in those days, when you had 8 inches of snow in Manhattan, the city was crippled.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we got to the show, we sat down and we realized there wasn't a lot, but there was empty seats everywhere.
Interesting.
People from upstate New York, from Jersey, they couldn't get to the show. So we sat down, and like I said, nobody was pushing, nobody was in the front. The band played to us like we were in my kitchen.
Yeah, and I think that's why the sound so good at that show, too, from that recording from the 12th. And Plant makes mention of that, you know, isn't it a good day when it snows?
So, I mean, yeah, he mentions it. He does mention but they're so at ease. Yeah. There's no crushing. There's no, like, sit down, you can't, you know, none of that stuff. It just, they played it, like I said, like they were in somebody's house.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the 12th is like ingrained in my brain. I could actually see them. And as a matter of fact, there's one point, you know, you always think, well, first of all, all these bands play to the first 10 rows. That's what they do.
Yeah.
Everybody else just happens to be in the place, but they play to the first 10 rows. So I'm sitting in the front row. I'm on Jimmy Page's side, and I used to incessantly chew gum like a horse chewing his cud. Yeah. Okay, I'm chewing, my mouth is going the whole show, okay?
Yeah.
I'm looking up at Page, he's 5 feet away from me, he looks down at me, and he starts chewing. And he did this a couple of times during the night. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is, yeah, I actually, you know, I caught his attention for 2 seconds, whatever it was, because we were so close, and it was so at ease. It was just one of the great shows.
One of the standouts of the show on the February 3rd, 1975 show that I thought was really cool, too, is before Communication, they do this funky jam, like a James Brown crunch thing.
Yep.
And
yep,
I've never heard that before. And I love it when the band does that because, you know, that's when they're, like you said, they're playing to you, they're at ease, they're just having a good time up there. Because that's the thing with Led Zeppelin. Every time you see pictures of them, they're always smiling, have a good time. So when you see them play like that, it's like, right on, you know, just give it to me, you know, rock out.
I mean, even if they're playing for their head, they're that good. You know what I mean? And at that time, they had their own record label. They were printing money. You know what I'm saying? You know, to make $30, $40 million on a tour in 1975 was extraordinary.
Yeah, and another thing, on the February 13th show at NASA, I know it's not recorded, or you didn't do the recording of it, but Ron Wood came out and played with them on Communication Breakdown, too. Do you have
Yes, absolutely.
We'd like to bring to the stage a good friend of ours, Mr. Ron Wood, Ronnie Wood. We're going to have a happening. Ron's going to do a little number by Victor Sylvester. Rod Stewart would have liked to have made it, but he's drunk in the back.
I'm going to write a little
my local DJ. They're just having a rehearsal, if you can bear with us for a bit.
One.
This is an old Lead Faces number called Communication Breakdown.
And real quick, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm trying to find it. I'm looking through Lucas Ray's book right now. One of the Nassau shows, I'll look while I'm talking to you. I recorded it in 75. The show is all cut up. Okay. And that's my show. And the reason why it's all cut up is because I didn't change the batteries on the machine.
Oh.
And the batteries started going, you know, about a third of the way into the show. And let me get the date here, February 2, 1275. And it's just in bits and pieces. And unfortunately, it was a really good show.
Hmm.
Here we go. February 4th, 1975, Nassau Coliseum. It gets worse as it ends. And everything is cut up. It's only 85 minutes in length. It's called Fragments. And again, while I was recording it, I realized the machine kept shutting off. And I said, why is this thing doing it? And then I looked at the battery power. It was in the red already. And I went, oh, Jesus. And I tried to even hold down the record button. It just wouldn't work. That was the only time I kind of screwed up. Because every night I changed batteries. Every night I did everything right. I fast-forwarded the tapes. I rewound them so they weren't tight. This night I just forgot to change the batteries.
Yeah.
Well, so that's the only time I screwed up.
Yeah. I could imagine recording, because you never know what it's going to sound like. It's like in the old days when we used to take pictures and bring in the film to get developed. You're just the anticipation of pulling it out of the envelope and seeing what those pictures look like. I'm sure you had that same anticipation on how that recording.
Yep.
So as soon as you get out to a place you could listen, it's like, let's listen to this. Let's see what it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Matter of fact, some people, you know, in on the websites complain that, you know, I'm always talking. And you know what it was? I was doing color commentary. You know, actually, I was sitting there and I was going, Nick, his voice sounds like shit, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he sounds terrible. And there is that one really interesting spot on the 75 shows. I think it was 237, whatever, whichever one it was, I looked up in a second. But where Nicky goes, look out for the soda, man. You're going to knock over the soda. And I go, fuck the soda. Light up the joint and the band hits the stage. Exactly. On cue. Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that in a movie any better.
You roll weed, didn't you?
Yeah.
One?
Yeah.
That's it?
I smoked them one. All right, it's up for soda.
Fuck the sodas, man. Light up the J.
Yeah! Woo! Yeah!
And I love listening to you because, I mean, you're like me at a show, just enjoying it. Because, you know, you know the songs. You're like, yeah. It just when you woo it and telling everyone to sit down at some parts, it's very cool.
Well, again, you know what it is, too, especially the 71 and the 72. Well, the 71 show especially, it's like a slice of life. You're hearing it as it happened with all the confusion and all the stuff that was going on, the stage collapsing. I mean, you're actually, it's a slice of time. It really, really is. It's just really, really nice. That, you know, you could hear that the way it is, the way it actually happened.
Yeah.
You know, definitely. And some people go, why didn't he shut up? Why didn't he keep? Well, I'm sorry, folks. That was just the way it was.
Yeah.
Enjoy what you can enjoy, because we certainly did.
So I want to recap these 1975 shows so the listeners really just kind of understand the wealth of shows you saw in 1975.
Yep.
So we have Madison Square Garden, February 3rd, NASA Coliseum, February 4th. Madison Square Garden, February 7th. Madison Square Garden, February 12th. NASA Coliseum, February 13th. NASA Coliseum, February 14th.
Right.
That is just incredible. I mean, it's just such a, like I said, it just, and your thought process is the February 12th was your favorite show. I would imagine being front row also helps.
Well, yeah, the other two at the Garden were really good too. Really, really good too. Like I said, if you noticed the 12th, Plant's voice was really, he was having a rough time. I mean, when he came out on stage, he gripped the microphone and he went, he was going, he couldn't even sing. And I sat there and they're going, oh no, don't tell me he's not going to be able to do nothing tonight.
Yeah.
But it's seared in my brain only because it's front row. and nobody was bouncing around near us. We could just sit there and just take the whole thing in from beginning to end. Yeah. It was tremendous. All the show that whole week, like I said, in 8 days I saw him 6 times. I mean, that whole week was nerve
wracking. Wow. Yeah, I didn't.
I mean,
think
it was
that.
Like, you know, it was insane. Oh, and before I forget, one more thing: sitting that close and watching Bonham do a 40-minute drum solo,
wow,
was just insane. I mean, it was just real, because you could hear him screaming and groaning.
Yeah, being that close.
And I remember I looked at Nick and I says, and we kind of laughed as if to say, this is crazy. I mean, you know, we could hear him going, you know, in between the little things he was doing. It was crazy. It was just crazy.
All right, so that wraps up the 1975 shows that you've seen and recorded. So I just want to kind of go back on this already, just to confirm.
Sure.
You recorded the NASA February 4th show. You mentioned that something was wrong with the batteries, or you didn't replace the batteries, so you didn't get a full show.
Right.
Right?
Usually my checklist from show to show would be to do everything, take the tapes, rewind them, fast forward them, make sure they weren't tight going into the machine, because that could be a problem. That particular night, for some reason, I didn't change the batteries from the last recording,
right,
2 days before. And when I started recording, I saw that the batteries were already in the red.
Oh.
You know, on the meter. And I said, Jesus, I says, maybe they'll make it. And of course they didn't make it.
Right.
The machine kept shutting off, and I held the record button down, and after a while it wouldn't hold anymore. And I just got 85 minutes of the
right.
show.
Well, at least we have something. And the reason I mentioned that too, because during the introduction I mentioned you recorded 9 shows. Well, in fact, you recorded 10 shows because I didn't count this show.
Yep.
So you have 9 really good shows, 10 shows are fragmented, but hey, it's something, it's documented Led Zeppelin. So that's what it comes down to.
Now, just real quick, you know, the unfortunate thing about that show that's fragmented is that I was really close. I was fourth row. And if you listen to the fragment, I didn't give it out to too many people. It's really clean, and the pieces are really good. So it's just a shame, you know, that I just did that.
Yeah,
well, what are you going to do?
So that concludes 1975. So with that going forward, we had the accident with Robert Plant in Greece.
Mm-hmm. Right.
During this time, we had rumors of the band breaking up because of Robert's accident and the Black Magic and so forth. Come 1976, we get the release of The Song Remains the Same. We do get the release of Presence. What was the mood back then in 1976 and 1977? Did you think Led Zeppelin was going to break up? Did you go see Song Remains the Same 20 times? I mean, what was that like?
I remember I actually went to premiere.
No,
the
nice.
Lowy's.
Yeah.
And I got in, you know, and let me tell you, it was not only was it packed, there had to be 400 or 500 people outside trying to get in. I mean, Led Zeppelin was still an important band at that time. And they created a lot of stir, you know. And again, like I said, it may have not been the best film, you know, as far as a live concert video goes, but I happened to like it. I thought it was fair.
I think from your standpoint, you must have known at that point that you were at all these shows. One, when you were there, you saw the cameras, but now that it's on the big screen and seeing it, it's like, that's pretty cool that, oh, I was at this show.
Yeah, I saw those 3 shows in 73 at the Garden. And like I said, it was a fair representation.
Right.
And, you know, I'm a big Robert Plant fan, and Plant's voice was at its peak in 73.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right after 73, it started to fail a little bit, and then he had surgery in 74. And, you know, and it's amazing that he was still smoking into the 80s.
Right.
But, you know, that was a peak. That was a peak for sure. They were really good in 73. They were really, really good.
Well, and the interesting thing that I always thought with 1977, it really became excessive, right? Because we have the very long, over-the-top Moby Dick solo by John Bonham. We have the noise solo, the bow solo for Jimmy Page. And these things were going 20, 30 minutes long. That had to be different than 75 vibe as well. What was your takeaway from that show?
Well, again, you know, from the tapes I have, thank God I have the tapes. There is one tape. We've talked about this, is that when Jimmy was at the beginning of Kashmir, he was doing the Thermalin thing, and he did one for like 20 minutes one night. He was just going. Then a guy next to me in the recording said, take some lessons. And I kind of looked at this guy and went, yeah, you know, that's an honest opinion. He was just kind of going off on a tangent, you know.
Right.
And again, I think that was because when you're so good and you're so powerful and you're doing everything and you get a little bit of drugs in there, you know, you're past the peak of your performance and it's time to maybe let it go.
So with these 77 shows, how was the ticket buying experience?
Well, the ticket buying experience was a little bit of a drag because what had happened was the first tickets that went on sale in 77 went on sale in Boston at the Boston Garden. They decided to sell the tickets to the fans directly at the venues that they were going to play at. The problem was, again, they were so popular that there was 30,000 people there, supposedly. That's what's been recorded on that. Mm-hmm. And they started breaking windows and rioting, and they stopped selling the tickets. And they made it, they put an ad in the Boston Globe, the newspaper. You had to cut out an ad, get a postal money order, and ask for certain tickets for certain shows. That's how they did it. That freaked me out. I mean, it really, really did freak me out because I figured, how am I going to get tickets?
Right.
I mean, Manhattan, 60,000 people could sell tickets in like an hour. So, and they put an ad in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And in the New York Times, basically, they listed the six shows that they were going to play at the Garden. You could only pick three dates, and you could only have two tickets from the three dates. So I was automatically cut into half of what the shows that I wanted to go see. So I got a hold of my mailman, this guy named Joey, and I said, Joey, what am I going to do? I mean, I got to get these tickets. He says, okay, what you do is you don't mail your tickets in your local post office because they go from the local post office to the main post office on 34th Street, which is across the street from Madison Square Garden. So what you do the night before the tickets get taken, you go to the main post office at 12 o'clock, and they got slots there, and at 12:01, you put your stamped envelope in the slot. Your envelope will go across the street in the first bag of mail in the morning, and you should do really well. And he was right. I got tickets for three shows. Now, the other three shows I wanted to cover, okay, and what I did was I was going to college at the time. I was going to Brooklyn College. They had a building for the students called Subu. It was the student union building, and we had these huge cork boards. People were selling books from classes and apartments they wanted to rent and everything. And a couple of people had one ticket left for certain Zeppelin shows.
Right.
And I was able to get one ticket for the last three shows, and I got to all six shows, which I was just lucky. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
You know, and the recordings that I did, you know, the 6:10, the 6:07, real quick, was the first night. And I picked those three nights, 6:07, 6:10, and 6:13, because I figured with a day off in between, Plant's voice would recuperate.
Right.
That's what I was trying to do. 6:07 was a decent show. It was a short show, however. They played less than 3 hours, and they made some mistakes. Kashmir had a mistake in timing where the band kind of went off into a different tangent. You can hear the errors. They cut the show short. It was only 170 minutes. And then and the show just stopped. There was no encores, and there was booing.
Wow.
At the end of the show, there was actually booing. Pretty cavernous booing, as a matter of fact. And I was a little disappointed, and I thought, God, I hope this all six isn't like this. But then we go to 6:08, which was the second night, and the band tried to dispel the negative of the previous night's show by putting on a good one, and they did. They did 190 minutes. Kashmir was perfect. The band tried hard to put on a good Led Zeppelin show, and like I said, it was over 3 hours, and it was a triumph. And I didn't record that one, unfortunately. Now, 6:10, 77, we're coming to the midpoint of 77. I wanted to do a special recording. I went out and I found a Nakamichi 550 portable, the same portable cassette deck that the band Page and Plant used when they went to Bombay to do the Bombay shows. And I had my poor girlfriend, got to give her a byline, Nisi Kaufman. She got this backpack, this 20-pound machine with 8D batteries. She put it on her backpack, and we created a diversion when we showed the tickets, and we snuck her through, and she got through.
Wow.
I didn't have a good seat that day. I was on like maybe 6 o'clock on a clock. The stage was at 12 o'clock, and I bought AKG microphones with pieces of wood, and with duct tape, I taped them, and I got them up there, and I got a really, really clean, good recording. It was a really good night. If anybody has 6:10, listen to it again. It's a really, really good recording, and it was very, very clean, and I think it was my best recording in 77. you know, and the show was, again, very good. They threw in a new song in the track list. They threw in Heartbreaker.
Oh, yeah.
And there was some explosive pods. You could hear the explosive pods go off from the oohs and the ahs from the audience. And it was a very enjoyable show. Next, we go to 6-11. 6-11 was good, even though there were more mistakes. Paige made some mistakes in Achilles' Last Stand and Bonham covered for him. But it was a good show all in all. You know, it was good. But again, you know, the energy level was a little down. You know, you could just hear it. But again, they were a professional rock band at the time. And they were very, very good. If you were seeing Led Zeppelin for the first time in your life right. in 77, you walked away going, my God, these guys are immense. That is the truth. 6-13, another good show. I recorded it. It was my last recording. I had closed sheets for that night. The only problem was that a lot of fireworks. The whole show has explosions in it. You could hear it all over the place, especially during Stairway to Heaven. And Bonham rejoins the group too early, one verse too early. And when Plant sings, it's not too late to change the road you're on. He goes, I hope so, Bonzo.
Did you use the Nakamichi deck for that one too?
No, I only used it one night. It was such a hassle.
Right, such a big
getting
machine.
The mother okay. in, bringing in, you know, sticks and everything. I decided I couldn't do it. 6-14-77, the last time I saw them in Madison Square Garden. I had a feeling that I wouldn't see them again. I was right. And again, the one regret I have was I didn't record it. I had great seats. I had Loge 47, which was on the right side of the stage. You could spit on the stage where I was sitting. Okay, it was right by Paige over there. They were great seats, and it was a very, very good show. The only problem was the end of the show, they walk off, the lights went on again, they came on for an encore. Because of the fireworks, somebody threw what they call a cherry bomb, and it missed Paige's hand by about 5 or 6 feet, but you can feel the concussion and the explosion.
Right.
And Paige grabs his hand, and Robert Plant comes on over and looks at his hand, and he turns around. He's got his microphone hanging down, but he says, that was a really silly thing to do. And he drops the microphone. They walk off the stage, and that was the end of Led Zeppelin New York.
Wow.
They never played again. And was that a foreboding? Was that something that was saying, hey, bad things are ahead for this band? I don't know. But it was the end of Led Zeppelin, but it was Led Zeppelin going into history.
Right. Well, I want to ask you, I mean, this is remarkable. This is seeing Zeppelin 8 days. With the span of 8 days, you see Zeppelin 6 times. So amazing.
6 times, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a dream come true, especially for any teenager.
Let me tell you.
Yeah.
It was a thrill.
Yeah.
It really, really was. To know that you were going to see, especially in 75, when they were like on all 8 cylinders, they were just cooking, man.
Right.
You know, and I sat them front row one of those nights. It was unbelievable, you know. And I tell this to people, and you know, you don't know how many people told me, you're full of baloney. Come on, what are you kidding? You saw them 6 times? No. Tell us the truth.
Yeah.
I go, yeah, I saw them 6 times. And 4 of those 6 shows, I was in the first 10 rows of the orchestra.
I'm going to go back to this 8 day stint of seeing Zeppelin 6 times. I mean, this band must have been incredibly loud, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of other bands back then as well. I mean, was it one of the loudest bands you've seen? And how are your ears after 8 days of seeing Led Zeppelin?
They were loud, but I the one thing I got to tell you, they carried a lot of very good expensive equipment with them. Most of these bands would use the venue's equipment that was hanging from the ceiling. These speakers that were just destroyed from hockey games and basketball games, and only a couple of stage amplifiers. That's all they would use, monitors they called them. But Led Zeppelin always had a lot of really quality, good equipment, high watt amps, orange crates, and things like that. And even though they were loud, the quality of the sound was very good. So it wasn't caustic to the ears,
and it reflects in the recordings too, which is good.
And there were, especially because I got close, you can hear it in the recordings. They're clean.
Yeah.
Not too much distortion. They're very, very good. I was just very lucky there with that. But Led Zeppelin, I think, went out of their way. They put their money where their mouth was. They knew, get some good stuff for the stage. You know, don't be stupid and buy crap, you know? That was the thing.
You recorded 3 of the 6 shows. What is the thought process back then as far as I'm going to record the 7th, the 10th, and the 13th? Or did you have it already mapped up? Was there a reasoning you only recorded those shows and didn't record all six of them? Was it just for convenience?
Well, again, you know what it was? 77, you know, I wasn't like 18 anymore. I was 25,
right.
Okay? And I was getting a little older. And if you notice, people who know my recordings, you know, I had a big mouth. and I was talking a lot in the early shows. I was happy. I was excited.
Sure.
You know, I was just doing my thing.
Right.
Now, in 77, I was a little bit more mature. I was sitting there. I wanted to watch the shows more. You know, that's just the way it is. You get a little bit mature. You just don't yell about, you know, light up the joint or something like that.
Yeah.
I just didn't do that in those days. But I picked the 7th, the 10th, and the 13th in 77 because I figured the first night of the tour, Plant's voice, because he hadn't played in 3 days,
right.
Would be good. And then the 10th, he would have a day off, actually 3 days off. And he would be, you know, good vocal quality at that time, too. And the 13th also. And his vocal quality was okay.
Yeah.
But again, you know, he had had surgery in 76. And actually, they probably should have taken more time off.
Who would have thought that, you know, almost nearly 50 years later of you recording these shows, we're still talking about them? Is that pretty cool? I mean, did you realize you're going to have that kind of impact on the Led Zeppelin community?
Not at all. I'm happy that in 2022, 2023, people are listening to these shows and leaving little things on YouTube saying, wow, this was great. I loved it.
Yeah.
Hey, if I'm making people happy in 2022 after 50 years, hey, well, how can it be bad? It's great. It's terrific.
Where are these masters now? Do you still have these?
Yeah, pretty much. They're all in a safe place. A friend of mine was a woodworker, and he made a really nice crate for me. And I have 6,000 cassettes.
Wow.
So I've got this big wall unit and these little drawers that come out, they're just a little bit bigger than the cassettes. They're put away. They've been also put on CD. They've been put on digital audio tape. They're in the computer. And every once in a while, I pull out the originals.
Okay.
And I kind of rewind them and fast forward them. And they seem to be okay. So 50 years, they're hanging in there.
Yeah.
Thank God, you know.
From what you're saying is you did make a digital copy. It sounds like you're into DAT recordings back in the day, I would guess, back in the 90s. And you made.
Yeah, when things changed and new things came in, I tried to upgrade them all and give them another copy and another medium.
Well,
so
very good.
We seem to be okay, you know.
Speaking of collectibles, you have any other Led Zeppelin collectibles laying around?
Oh, God, I got a ton of stuff. And we spoke of the fact that eventually I'm probably going to have to, you know, get rid of them. I, you know, what's funny about collecting is this, and I've only realized this as I've gotten older, is that anything you collect, I don't care if it's the Hope Diamond, the Mona Lisa, or Led Zeppelin-related material, you know, you don't keep it forever.
Right.
You're just a caretaker for a certain period of time, and I realize that to be the truth now myself. Yeah, I have all kinds of test pressings. I have an ES-1275 that Jimmy Page signed for me, double neck guitar, a red one. You know, things like that. A lot of, I have an object.
Oh, nice.
One of the objects floating around. Yeah, it's a low number object. I just took it out of the box maybe 3 months ago the first time. And
cool.
Eventually we got to let these things go. I mean, I hate to, but I don't think you bring them in the box with you when you go, you know.
As much as you want
you
to.
unless you want to. You really, I know of a guy who got buried in his Porsche, but that's a little ridiculous. And you know, and again, you know, I could just got to let them go, you know, and I'll do that. Well, maybe we'll talk about that at some point, you know.
Before I let you go, I always like to ask my guests these one-word answer questions. So I'm going to ask you some questions, and if you just answer me with one or two words, of course, let me know. So let's dive into this. What's your favorite Led Zeppelin LP?
Wow. Physical Graffiti.
Favorite Led Zeppelin song?
Over the Hills and Far Away.
What was the last Led Zeppelin song you listened to?
I think last night I listened to Kashmir.
Hmm. And then favorite Led Zeppelin live year?
75. Yeah, no doubt about it. 75.
And what is your favorite Led Zeppelin show you recorded?
Gosh, that's a tough one. If I can give you just two answers, 71 is just extraordinary,
right?
And 212.75 because of being close to the stage.
And what was the first bootleg you listened to?
Blueberry Hill.
Very good. And Jimmy Page or Robert Plant fan? I think you already answered this one, but
The attraction was Robert Plant, and I learned to really get into Jimmy Page.
Yeah. Should they have continued after the O2 show?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, very good. I agree. Well, very good. Artie, I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your story. Like I mentioned earlier and that you just mentioned, I mean, these tapes have been around for decades. And from collector standpoints like myself or anyone who's heard these tapes, your name has been well known for recording these New York shows. And, you know, it's such an honor to talk to you. And I'm sure everyone listening to this will agree with me that it's great to hear the backstories of all these shows. And we can't thank you enough because, again, it's almost 50 years later and you're still talking about these shows. So thank you so much.
Well, Mark, I appreciate the opportunity to get them out there. The more people that listen to it and put a smile on their face, the better. And I just want to say again, I think I've said this before, but to most Led Zeppelin fans, if you're listening to them still, you got good taste, okay? Right. Listen to them, enjoy them, because, you know, even today, they're probably the best blues rock band that there ever was.
Yeah, I hear that. Well, I think that's going to be a perfect wrap for us. Let's wrap it up there. Thanks again, Artie, for joining me, and have a wonderful
day.
Thank
you very much, man.
All right, Artie. Wow, that was episode 22, and that was a mind-blowing episode 22. The dude saw Zeppelin 19 times, and thank you so much for recording them 10 times. So we can't thank you enough, Artie. Thanks for sharing all those wonderful stories. And I just want to recap real quick on all the shows that Artie attended. He saw the band May 30th, 1969 at the Fillmore East, September 19th, 1970, evening show, Madison Square Garden. Madison Square Garden, September 3rd, 1971. NASA Coliseum, June 15th, 1972. Madison Square Garden, July 27th, 28th, and 29th, 1973. The Fabulous, Song Remains the Same performances. Moving to 75, he saw Madison Square Garden, February 3rd, 1975. NASA Coliseum, February 4th. Madison Square Garden, February 7th. Madison Square Garden, February 12th. NASA Coliseum, February 13th. NASA Coliseum, February 14th. My gosh, and it goes on. We have more. So he saw all the nights in 1977 at Madison Square Garden. That would be June 7th, June 8th, June 10th, June 11th, June 13th, and June 14th. So Artie, I thank you. Everybody listening, thank you for recording these wonderful shows and sharing all these experiences with us and kind of just telling us what it was like seeing Zeppelin. So definitely appreciated. I think that's a wrap, everyone. Go listen to some Zeppelin. And just remember, if you got love, you ain't lonely. Have a good night. Cheers.